Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a poetry reading and discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the literary journal AGNI. Speaking will be Polish poet and translator Tomasz Rozycki and poet Major Jackson, associate professor of English at the University of Vermont and a faculty member of the Bennington Writing Seminars. We begin with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
Good evening. Welcome, everybody. I'm very happy to see you here. And tonight we are bringing you two very outstanding poets, Tomasz Rozycki and Major Jackson. They are very different poets, but they represent the same generation, and therefore we are hoping that at the end of our conversation, after the reading, and then a short conversation, and maybe conversation with the public, that we'll find out the similarities, affinities between them. I will just say a few words about the two poets. Tomasz Rozycki is a poet and translator. He lives in Opole, in a city in Poland, where he was born. And to date, he published five collections of poems, and his fifth volume, Colonies, was nominated right now for the Nike Literary Award, which is one of the most important, most prestigious Polish literary awards. And his poems have been translated into many languages. And here we have the first volume of his poetry, which was published in English, the first in English. And he writes poetry, but he also wrote an epic and long epic poem, of which the beginning of which, the opening part of which, was included in high school examination in Poland, which may mean that he's becoming a classic as we as we look at him. Major Jackson is the author of two collections of poetry, Hoops from 2006 and Living Saturn from 2002, and also one of these books we have here for you. He's the winner of the 2000 Kaveh Kanem Poetry Prizes, and finalist for a National Book Circle's National Book Critics Circle Award. His poems have appeared in the American Poetry Review, in Boulevard, in Kalaloo, in Strike Quarterly, and in The New Yorker, among other literary journals and anthologies. He is an associate professor of English at the University of Vermont and a faculty member at the Bennington Writing Seminars. And last academic year, he was a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard University. And so we will start with Tomasz reading his poems, but we'll ask Bill Pierce from AGNI to read the poems in English. And Tomasz will read in Polish, some of them. And then Major Jackson will read his poems. And then we'll sit here and have a short conversation, and then we'll open it to the public.
I'm going to start with Tomasz's poem, Coffee and Cigarettes, and then he's going to read that same poem in Polish. When I first started writing, I didn't yet know what poems would do to me, that I'd become some perpetually sleep-deprived phantom with see-through skin, that I'd wander around the city on some kind of high and only go to bed with the furious dawn. And at daybreak, I'd still be dropping in on friends, flat broke like a louse, some kind of vermin, summoned in sleep by a bit of bare skin or maybe a sigh. And honey, I didn't even know what these dumb poems would finally turn me into, and that you'd be the one to summon me to life, and that because of you alone I would be visible, that I'd lie down beside you and wait out the moment till you drop off to sleep.
Kawa i tytoń. Kiedy zacząłem pisać, nie wiedziałem jeszcze, co ze mnie zrobią wiersze. Że się przez nie stanę jakimś dziwnym upiorem, wiecznie niewyspanym o przezroczystej skórze, chodzącym po mieście jakby lekko naćpany, kładącym najwcześniej się razem z wściekłym brzaskiem i jeszcze nad ranem łażącym po znajomych, zupełnie spłukany jak jakaś menda, insekt, przywołany we śnie kawałkiem gołej skóry, czy może westchnieniem. I nawet nie wiedziałem, w co mnie wreszcie zmienią te durne wiersze, skarbie, i że to ty właśnie przywołasz mnie do życia, i że dzięki tobie tylko będę widzialny. Z tobą się położę i odczekam tę chwilę, dopóki nie zaśniesz.
The volcano. Sitting and watching the war of the airplanes against the skyscrapers, the holy war of martyrs against subway cars and gymnasiums, against children. Lying down and observing the flood in 40 live episodes, putting the world in order with the remote control, browsing, trying to dodge the murderer, the shark. Hearing the results of the audience questionnaire on the death penalty. Sleeping a little, taking in a little of the momentous broadcast from the auctioning of God. And seeing them all tiny, cartoonish, how they keep falling down, how they try to stand up, then fall down again. Turning off the sound and picture, turning off my breath, but not being able to turn off my heart, I fell. Drifting. Night trains, Poland. A rolled cigarette slowly starts to glow from out of the ragged darkness. Like a stray spark. It's leading a soul from a supple body into the light and very slowly coaxing it to dance. This way, that way. It hurts a little bit. It always hurts like this the first time. So there is nothing, a nothing that has color, a nothing that holds power over physics. It hurts. With smoke and fire, we will defend ourselves. We will invoke one another and multiply, materialize, exist so strongly as to become visible from outer space, a spark. We will drift because we have lost contact with the base, with Earth, and in time also with time. Poland, a night train travels from town A to town B. You work out the delay. I'm going to read Dolphins, and then why don't you read Dolphins after that in Polish. When I first started writing, I didn't yet know that I would die, because death didn't yet exist. Humankind lived in an age of gold, and on the streets the air smelled of metal. When I first started writing, I had no idea that the map ends somewhere, and at the edge of the world there's a writhing monster, and that the ocean, ships, and dolphins wash into its jaws. That every night death takes my measurements and collects my stray hairs and fingernail clippings and flaked off skin. That from it all death will render its own face in my likeness. And that when it arrives, I will be an anti-I. When I first started writing, I didn't yet know that I was writing about that. That I was crumbling into 1,000 letters, flakes of soot, poisonous dust.
Delfiny. Kiedy zacząłem pisać, nie wiedziałem jeszcze, że umrę, ponieważ nie było jeszcze śmierci. Ludzkość żyła w wieku ze złota i na ulicach czuć było w powietrzu metal. Kiedy zacząłem pisać, nie wiedziałem jeszcze, że mapa gdzieś się kończy i na skraju świata wije się ten potwór, do którego paszczy wlewa się ocean, statki i delfiny. Że śmierć będzie ze mnie brać co nocy miarę i zbierać po mnie wypadłe włosy, paznokcie i złuszczoną skórę. I że z tego będzie swą twarz czynić na moje podobieństwo. I że kiedy nadejdzie, to będę antyja. Kiedy zacząłem pisać, nie wiedziałem jeszcze, że piszę właśnie o tym, że tak się rozpadam na 1000 literek, sadzę, trujący pył.
This will be the last of Thomas's poems before the discussion. Ants and sharks, for AB. An ant devours a larva according to the laws of nature, and a child eats the ant. It burns slightly on the tongue. Curiosity always burns. On Paradise Beach in Goa, a shark will swallow the child. But God will capture the shark when he sees it from above, just as he catches a rat, a tigress, an elephant. And then the poet sitting in his room will devour God. The poet will, alas, feed on everything. He is a monster that bulges and excretes like a boar. He feeds on paper. If you let him, he will find on the sheets the hidden traces of dreams and of love. He will pilfer whatever you have that is holy, chew it up, swell with white flesh and poisonous bristles. It's enough to touch or brush up against him by accident.
Thank you, Tomas and Bill. Bill, I may need some help. I want to thank Arina Krosinska-Gross for the introduction and reading with Tomas, whose work I've have been reading over the past week, and he's just a wonderful poet in translation here. And it's hard for me to imagine contemporary poetry without the Eastern and European poets, Miłosz and Zagajewski and Zbigniew and Zimborska in translation. And it's nice to know that that's continuing. So thank you for your work. I'm just going to read a few poems from Hoops. And I'm going to start off with, I have some friends that got married this summer on July 7th, 2007. And 777. So they was trying to beat the odds by putting on that lucky day. So they asked for a poem, and I think it's a poem that kind of straddles the role that I feel poets play in communities, both one of celebration and celebrating communities, but also protesting, just kind of somewhat staying within the theme of today, poetry and politics. Epithalamium, 777. And as a gift, I told them that I would read it throughout 2007. I would read this poem at readings. They met and some would say found their earth. I shall raise a silent glass evermore around the earth. This city, no way, is the same. Amor and Sonia are one. On other continents on this day, wars fester and wound the earth. Henceforth and forever, she'll say, my darling. He'll reply, my sweets. And a kiss shall drown the earth. We hold their promise like a fresh loaf. That kiss spins within us and astounds the earth. Marriage is a vacation of a lifetime. The lake sings at the shore of the heart. No cloud shall darken their earth. Each other's fever, each other's avalanche, rose, spine, coffee pot, garden, nouns, earth. In the winter of their lives, we wish them fire and a dance, an elegance choreographed to calm the earth. May they walk with ancestors, slurp soup loudly from ladles. May they sprawl about Sunday mornings as bombs pound the earth. May they never be alone in each other's arms. May they cultivate what they sow on earth. May they touch goodness inside of them, hear the hum of insects summer nights. May they call their parents, even miles away from earth. May they care for dogs and children, bring bright tomorrows. May they turn off cell phones and talk in person, buy rutabagas while armored tanks roam the earth. What's left to report, visit the opera, buy good music, call their friends, invest now and forever, make a sound unique on this earth. This book has a letter to the poet Gwendolyn Brooks, who served as a model for me and a host of poets, generations, a couple generations after her. And this letter, this particular section I'm going to read, is meant to be a travelogue, but this particular section finds me resting and addressing her, particularly on something that she said about art, and you'll hear it. the strange terrain ourselves we tore in art. You said it first, art hurts, the reflection fogless by the hour. Oblivion girdles the frame, distorts, makes plain we are not who we say we are. In the showdown between art and life, jump cut, a face-off, the hard-boiled fight. Tonight I'll crumple like a thundercloud and tint my head in a trench coat, a litany of leaves miss my eyes and shrouds the orchestral rage of grace notes. Think of all the veins of a straining throat. Think of a Miri squatting on time's hoard. Think of the beast impaled on his sword. This flat beach of a page speaks beyond the grave, a summoning akin to Lazarus of Bethany, who leaped from his sepulcher as from a bunk bed and sparked with Dante, that noble trend, the dead holding hands. In dark woods, the living go on separated by blood, yet join in fear, which is to say we are never alone. I throw up a prop of furs with their tremble of supple tops and smear the scene of blackest green and propel us to Rousseau's carnival, then dot the sky a silken moon, then a soft stroke for a road, pluming the canvas like a blade of petrified smoke. In this mise-en-scene, the soul's less an abstraction, less terrorized, like little red writing finding solace in the offering. A basket of sweet rolls, sliced apples, victuals for the wolf's hanker. What if said disciples followed the loathsome heed, never talked to strangers? Turning away, we write and often plunge to routine deaths and give over to the inner ogre who directs and solos our grungy ecstasy of transport, a potential trudge of desultory dimensions. My Virgil, you'd have polished off this couplet with Virgil. I'll say it, poetry debates are quite the bore. Many road in bad taste, like the one page versus stage. More so when bombs make bites of all we write. Performance poets run the risk of outperforming the poem. Some gesture little or too much. Many should quit, just drop the mic. And this section of the letter finds me in, where am I? I think I'm in Franconia, New Hampshire at the Frost Place. And during that time, the U.S. had just entered Iraq. Gwen, I am glad you're not living at this hour, for we are like the kid pushed in a yard who pushes back, then finding his power becomes the bully with no regard for what hates he sows. How soon our scars fade, the light of an empire ages, daily seas rumble below, repeating man's history. September triggered a rash of abuses all around. I'm concerned for Langston's future. We are not rich enough to avoid conscription. He'll earn his stripes, I hope, by not harming other parents' children, but performing acts of diplomacy, which today smack of the dress rehearsal before the attack. How would you have responded? Images of men and women beheaded or stacked before a camera, the mental war waged before a camera, the mental war waged in our name. Who foretold the carnage or the beast beneath our skin? How we proclaim civility, then digitize the cave whence we came. Our psyche takes the beating. Six hooded Iraqis lurk behind us in our dreams. When the axe swings, we awakened, doomed to not hear the Sanskrit above our screams. My grandfather came on the scene the same year as you, stunning to think of the horrors of the century in his head. In a corner, the child in him crouches as the room darkens. He was born to a world at war, and expects to die a night of bombs, evening the score. When I fire up my laptop, he shirks and cannot take more of the world at work. Enough electric spanking, he seems to say, nor believes men on the moon to this day. Question, how much headway can we take? Are we advancing faster than our blood courses? Much we've already taken at a lightning pace, over flooding perhaps what our brains can endure. you'd giggle at the breakthroughs of the past decade. For one, robots disarming bombs in caves. The wireless world we live permits instant admission. The internet shrinks the globe. We've hotspots to our bank accounts. The Hague stores our homes. I can disrobe on a beach and never cease the work mode. We've developed at last alternative ways to move our cars. Hybrid engines free us all the more from excessive costs at the pump. And our fin this year go despair of OPEC's siphoning of American pockets. I predict once we're through altogether with oil, the only vehicles left to fuel will be machines of war, our children sure to become Lowell's ghosts orbiting forever on a big screen, a reality show we will likely sell to the public as a means of swelling national pride, and our time a hello value that just zapped from the red, white, and blue. Of TVs, we hunger for bigger screens, better sounds. XM and Sirius broaden the waves with satellites and crystal clear tunes, or the news, the man in Tiananmen Square and I can synchronize more than our thirst for democracy. We can get our fill on Dylan, Coldplay, and Cypress Hill. Kids no longer devour dots. Gaming videos turn them to fighters who hunt bad guys. Fully armed imaginary worlds like Halo ensure no one different catches the prize. In Grand Theft Auto, they've even devised squalid streets that let you explore the thug within. So soccer moms jacking rides for drugs. Computer chips are smaller than fingerprints. We've acronyms for it all. With GPS, you never guess where you're going. With Sprint phones, just about anyone can be a spy. Every cell is a cam, and every cam an eye. Picture the universe through a single bubble, planets billions of years away through the Hubble. An unmanned spacecraft landed on Mars. iPods will never leave you without a song. My students walk the quad like Martians. Biotech firms go cloning along. Stem cells can remake our bones strong. We are mapping the human genome. Soon we'll design kids to match our homes. I looked you up this morning. 81,000 results with audio links, biographies, profiles, and pics. Your life summed and presented to the tyro in a blink. Substitute the Cartesian logic I think to I Google, therefore I am. And you've uncovered our zeitgeist, the groove of an era. Our mark on earth measured in binary codes, not by deeds, which totaled many for you. So many claim your sway. Treasure your artful phrasings and praise. Fell under your spell like electricity to thunder, and I, like them, value you above all else, indispensable poet of the public's health. I begin this stop all wrong. You should be living at this hour. We need your bolts and resounding palms like we need sweet honey in the rock, sacred songs, a revolt against plain figurings. New and bold metaphors to help us keep people always in vision to fight the corporate bugs away. I'll just read two more. This is called Urban Renewal 19. And the image here is my grandmother was an evangelist, and so we went to church. As kids, we went to church, even when we didn't want to go to church, particularly on Wednesday night prayer revivals. And the image that lingers in my imagination is that moment when people would get the Holy Ghost and fall down. They'd get touched, and they would fall down. That moment in church, when I stared at the Reverend's black kente paneled robe and sash, his right hand clasping the back of my neck, the other seizing my forehead, standing in his watch this pose, a leg behind him ready to spring, his whole body leaning into the salvation of my wizened soul. I thought of the Saturday morning wrestlers of my youth who'd hold their opponents till they collapsed on a canvas in a slumberous heap, and how it looked more like a favor, a deed, though barbarous, a graceful tour out of this world, that scathonic departure back to first waters. And wondered what pains I endured in Mr. Feltyberger's physics class, worshiping light, density, mass, preferring to stare long at snow domes or the carcasses of flies pooling above in the great fluorescent cover, and how beds are graves, my mother and father kissing each other's head, their cupped faces unhurriedly laying the other down, and how all locked embraces light in my mind from below and blue neon like you'd find on the undercarriage of sports cars. And then what came was the baker stacking her loaves one by one into little coffers, and Desdemona's last surrender to Othello's piercing glance, and Isaac shone a militia of clouds over Moriah, and the dying we submerge in the baptism of pillows, and how we always loiter at this verge there between rising up and falling back, as in now this tank of sound I'm swimming in, gripped between the push and yank of his clutch, caught in that rush of tambourines next to solemn trays of grape juice and bits of crackers held by deacons, when the reverend, serious as a pew, whispered, "Fall back, my son, fall." I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
I will start with a question that is, since we are looking for affinities. Your poetry, Major, is very, the what you read now, because it's not, I know that it's not usual for you. It was very political, in a very direct way. And the question that I have is, what do you think, it's not something that you do very often, as far as I can say, yes? So what do you think, what is your role? Whom do you represent? What, as a poet, why is it that you write that from time to time, and what does it express?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, poetry very much wants to capture, extreme moments of feeling, not extreme necessarily, but I think poets are moved by either, extreme moments of felt beauty or felt love and affection and felt anger. In that particular case, I think that poem on that particular day struck me, or came to me, or wanting to finally write about the kind of the war that we find ourselves in. I think that particular day I was in Starbucks, and there was the New York Times, and there I was buying my latte, and on the front cover was this kid who couldn't have been not too much older than my son, and I thought about the relative leisure. So I think it was a particular trigger, and my hope, and I know, it's not my hope, I know that the feelings of being at a great distance, at a great remove from violence by which a country that I live in, that I claim citizenship, finds themselves. I feel like, one of the poet's jobs, of course, is to articulate that sense of dis-ease. So you're right, it's not something that I do frequently, but I think there are certain moments in which poets should kind of direct their attention and their creativity towards some larger purpose. And I happen to come from a tradition of poets in which it's not something that we separate, this kind of lyric voice and this political voice. It's all in the tradition of poets or lineage that I claim.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And can you name that lineage?
Yeah, I think going all the way back to, let's say, the great abolitionist poet Francis E.W.
Harper, for example, who whose poetry took on an oratorical, rhetorical function. Mm-hmm. And not only was she articulating the plight of Afro-Americans in this country, but also articulating the plight of women, and very active from the podium, both with her poetry, but also her speeches. But going, you know, going that far back, and even going, looking at poets who, on the surface, you don't think that their work is political. Say someone like Robert Hayden, for example, who was deemed somewhat apolitical during a very charged moment in American history in the 60s and 70s. Or even today, you know, poets who are doing very interesting things on the page with language. There's something intrinsically political about it, because they're taking the language itself, they're going to the language itself, and hoping to change structurally how we think about ourselves and the world, how the world is represented. Yeah.
And of all the poems that I know of you, Tomasz, the none of them is as directly political as the first poem was that Major was reading. So, what can you say about the relationship between politics and your poetry, and how you feel about it? And do you think it is present in your poetry? Mm-hmm.
Yes. And first, I must say I'm very glad to be here with you and with invited by Irena and with Major Jackson. I think we are very similar. Because both of us, we are very, very young, very, very beautiful, and very, very rich. And I think that poetry is always a way of representing of different adventures and misadventures of a soul. Mm. And I think when the politics attacks you, and politics when the politics try to change your life, you must say something. You must write it down and write it against this attack. Mm. So I think poetry is not it's something completely different to the politics, but when politics try to change our life, we must simply we feel something against this action. And So why there is a little bit? I think it's maybe the subjects more than politics subjects and of historical subjects in my poems are very, very frequent, and I think this is a history of Poland, of my family, of my tribe, and of my city, which is very important to me, and which is always there when I start to write. It's always behind me. Some stories, for example.
And would you be also able, like Major did, kind of to show us the lineage? Whom are the poets that, when you speak, who are kind of hovering in the back, looking at you, trying to influence you?
I think in Polish poetry, there are this generation of Miłosz and Herbert. I know Helbent and Miłosz, this is not real the same generation, but let's say this generation, one of the greatest generation in Polish poetry, has a great and very important influence in my poetry, and it's always between a sense of rebellion against this generation and someone he continue this way of seeing and presenting ideas, political ideas. I think it's Herbert and Miłosz, but also romantic poetry, Polish romantic poetry.
And if you would think about non-American poets, mm-hmm. and some other outside non-American tradition, do you feel that you are influenced, you are in some kind of a strong relation to some mm-hmm. non-American poetry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, for me, the poems that do not set out to be political wind up being the very, you know, they're just a statement about, you know, just writing about the particulars of the world. And so Eastern European poets and kind of metaphysical dimension through the small things in the world have been very important to me, and I teach Miłosz's song on the end of the world just mm-hmm. about every yeah. semester, and you know, I think I've acknowledge Zagajewski in public, but definitely South American poets, Nicolas Guillen, and I think it's one of the interesting things about Afro-American poets that I wish the rest of the world knew, I wish the critics acknowledged, which is this kind of dialogue, whether it's Eastern, whether it's East Asian poets or Southern American poets, African-American poets, always been global because there is a particular position that African-Americans write from in this country that other people find relevant. That's always been the case, whether it's, you know, Langston Hughes being celebrated in Russia or Asia, and poets like Mary Baraka and Sonia Sanchez down in Brazil, you know. So, you know, I thank you for this program because for me it helps extend that conversation just a little bit more. But I think it's also, you know, it sets for me, it also talks about the work of a journal like Callaloo, for example, who works, editor there, Charles Rao, who works very actively to continue the dialogue that Afro-American poets have long been having with global poetry.
Mm-hmm. And what about you also from this point of view? Tomasz is professor of French literature and French language and a translator of French poetry. Is this a vital influence for you? Was this a vital influence? Is this the culture to which you refer? Are these the poets that are behind you when you are writing?
Yes, I think it's always behind me, but I don't know which kind of inspiration it is. I think I have many inspiration from Russian, for example, literature, from German literature, and from Ukrainian literature, new literature, young literature, and I think it's always many inspiration. It's sure, I am inspired by French literature, because I teach French literature, and I must read all the poems and be au courant. It's a very amazing way of inspiration, I think, because I never know how much the poem which I write is important to me. I think when you choose some poems, it's something special, special reason for choosing this one and not another one. So it's but I don't know, it's quite a mystery, I think.
And both of you are poets and teachers of poetry, and I wonder are you teachers because you have to? Are you teachers because you think people can learn how to write poetry? Or are you teachers because you are teaching certain kind of culture? And what would be, this is also another thing very important for me, what would be the ideal way of teaching poetry in an ideal global university or local university in which you could design it all by yourself?
Right. I think I've been thinking a lot about this lately, because, you know, the idea of an anthology is fantastic. On one hand, you have this kind of meal after meal after meal, but I think if I could just assign my students maybe 2 poems a month, so that would give them about 8 poems that they learned. I mean, really learned those poems, learned them by heart, took them into their body, but also the historical and aesthetic circumstances around those poems, because poems are born out of a life, despite what some critics say, and a particular period. And so it would be part, and hopefully those poems that I chose would teach them something about experiencing the world, not just through language, but teach them how to see, teach them how to hear, teach them about ethics, teach them about anthropology, geography. Hopefully there's something that they can take, meatier, it's just sticking with that theme of Eden Mill, other than just kind of a mere encounter with language. Mm-hmm. So I would take probably 8 poems and maybe even visit the places that those poems may conjure, either in a book or physically. Whole classes can be designed around certain poems. My friend Elizabeth Alexander is in the audience and wrote a wonderful poem called The Venus Hottentot, which takes up the work of the scientist Cuvier and his exploiting a South African woman during for a World's Fair, putting her on display. And I think there's so much in that poem and other poems by my friends that do more than just kind of exist on the page. So that's how I would that's how I would teach it. Yeah.
I hate teaching. it's always it's. for me, many, many times, if I love one poem very, very much, the same poem is completely misunderstood by my students, and it's very confusing when you love something. And I think poetry is very personal, and you cannot make somebody love something when he doesn't love. It's impossible. So it's very, but it's wonderful when it works.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful, and it works always for two persons, two, three students. It's very, very. Sometimes it works for a whole group, but it works for two or three people only, always. So it's very personal, I think.
Maybe the public would know. Maybe we would like to ask some questions to our poets.
You guys are poets and talking about politics. When does politics actually affect a poet for you guys?
Mm-hmm. When there is something on TV, for example, or on newspaper, which makes me nervous. It's when I feel something, when I see a politician on TV, president, for example, or another one, and I feel angry or I have some feelings. And I feel emotion and feelings. It's the base for the poetry, and you make poetry with this emotion, with these feelings. So, and with the words, but it's like that.
Writer and philosopher Albert Camus used to talk about, he has this passage where he talks about the artist used to be able to sit in the stadium while the little peons were getting chased by the bulls, and artists can look up at the sky and look at the stone benches and write about that or paint that, and now the artist finds themselves in the middle, right? Down in the stadium, being chased themselves, you know. So I think for me, it is a kind of daily encounter. But it's also you know, one of the things that I think the great conversation that writers find themselves, artists, thinkers find themselves in, is they're driven by the mystery of existence. And so I find certain ideologies that hope to explain away that mystery, political as well. And so there's particular conversations. It may not be necessarily what's on TV or whatever, but certain conversations that are out in the world that I think are either too narrow or dehumanizing certain groups, certain people, certain things I can hear in public on, you know, on the subway or the train or walking down the street, that's a political moment. It's political to live, you know. So I don't make a distinction as to certain moments, but knowing that just this being able to sit here right now and then have this discussion is in itself a political act. And so I have to keep reminding myself that. Because it's also part of privilege, and privilege is about power. I mean, just think about some of the young kids your age or younger being cast into a war that they had no decision to be involved or not. You know, so this moment right here is. So that's a good question, though. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Yeats says that we make poetry of our quarrel with ourselves. And I'm curious to know what the relationship is between the narrative I, the speaker in your poems, and yourself outside the poems, the I beyond the poems.
I, my poems, is wiser, smarter, sexier. You know, there's some point where, you know, you're writing and you're tapping into the whole wealth of your being. And so there's a mythologizing of the self that happens at that moment. I make bad decisions in my life. It seems like the voice on the page seems sturdier and more exalted. And it's the same experience that you have when you read a journal entry or something that you written 5-10 years ago.
I, in my poems, are sometimes it's a superhero, sometimes it's someone who is very, very stupid. And I hope I'm not like this person who lives in my poems. It's like emanation of our, I don't know, when we sleep, there is someone who starts to live in our place and starts to do something in our place. And he lives and he makes something, and it's like a dream, you know, it's a person of dreams. Yes, I think. It's a monster. It's a monster. Thank you.
You've been listening to a poetry reading and discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the literary journal AGNI. Our speakers were Polish poet and translator Tomasz Rozycki and poet Major Jackson, associate professor of English at the University of Vermont and a faculty member of the Bennington Writing Seminars. We began with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's show was produced by Mike Toda and Tim Skoog with help from Jared Mooney. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.